left off yesterday talking about the birth pains, the beginning of sorrows. And as we go through these verses here that we've got on the overhead, what I hope that we can do is see that when the Lord has given these few initial signs and said these are just the beginning of birth pains, as we read through these references, notice that clearly if we understand when the birth happens, we will understand that what started in those days leading up to AD 70 is still going on, in essence. The birth pains are still going. There has not been a birth yet. So, and I think it's important to understand this because the disciples would have understood when the Lord said, these are the beginning of birth pains. I think these references to Isaiah would have appeared in their mind. And they would have understood then that all these sorrows were going to lead up to something very important. So, chapter 13 of Isaiah, verses 6 through 13. How ye, for the day of Yahweh is at hand. It shall come as a destruction from the Almighty. Therefore shall all hands be faint, and every man's heart shall melt, and they shall be afraid. Pangs and sorrows shall take hold of them. They shall be in pain as a woman that travaileth. They shall be amazed at one another. Their faces shall be as flames. Behold, the day of Yahweh cometh, cruel both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. Notice verse 10. This is kind of a prefigure to what we're going to get to a few verses later. For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. Does that sound like an echo of a verse we're going to get to shortly in Matthew 24? It's a good one to pay note to. Think about it. The sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. And I will punish the world for their evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. And I will cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease, and will lay low the haughty of the terrible. I will make a man more precious than fine gold, even a man than the golden wedge of Ophir. Therefore I will shake the heavens and the earth, shall remove out of her place, in the wrath of Yahweh of hosts, in the day of his fierce anger. So we see that Isaiah had already given this great prophecy about the birth pangs and sorrow being associated with judgment. So this is a real important reference the Lord's given in the Olivet Prophecy. And these men, you know, sometimes I think we wrongly portray the disciples as individuals who didn't know anything about the Scriptures, and that's really not fair. I mean, now I really am deviating from my notes, and I wonder why I can never finish a class. What did Philip say to Nathanael when he rushed to him after he met the Lord? He rushed to him and said, I have found him who the law and the prophets have spoken of. So they knew their Bibles. And I think these verses would have come to their mind. All right, let's go to Isaiah 26. Read 17 through 21 there. And this one I think is particularly interesting, but the last one is very telling. Isaiah 26, 17 through 21. Like as a woman with child that draweth near, the time of delivery is in pain, and crieth out in her pangs. So have we been in thy sight, O Yahweh. We have been with child, we have been in pain. We have, as it were, brought forth wind. We have not wrought any deliverance in the earth, neither have the inhabitants of the world fallen. And then verse 19, pay attention. Thy dead men shall live. Together with my dead body shall they arise. Awake and sing, ye that dwell in dust. For the dew is as the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead. Come, my people, enter into thy chambers, and shut the doors about thee, and hide thyself, as it were, for a little moment, until the indignation be overpassed. For behold, Yahweh cometh out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity, the earth also shall disclose her blood and shall no more cover her slain. You know, as I read verses like this, I think one of the things that is a marvel to me as you study throughout the entirety of the gospel accounts is how the Lord could say so much with so little. I mean, can you really see how so much is just taught in that simple phrase where we're at right now in verse 8 of Matthew 24? These are the beginnings of sorrows. You know, there was so much that the Scriptures had already said that could be read into that. And the Lord knew that. The power of the Scriptures taught so much. And this verse, I think, clearly would have helped the disciples. We understand at this moment they were troubling with their understanding, but after the Lord's resurrection, would they see clearly then that the Lord had taught that while these signs leading up to AD 70 were just the beginning of sorrows, that these sorrows would pass? And what else was taught? They knew that the resurrection would have to happen now when these sorrows were come to their end. So really, I think you see the doctrine of resurrection is already being pointed forward to in this eighth verse of Matthew 24. That before all this sorrow can be over, that would take place. All right, Isaiah 66, verses 5 through 14. And I would just tell you, there's one verse in here that I think we have, in the Christadelphian body, too often quoted out of context. You know, for you young people, isn't that one thing that's unique about us as Christadelphians? I mean, you heard some three classes on the history of the growth of Christadelphians over the last couple of nights, but we're not too proud to note that sometimes we get it wrong, right? That's the one thing that's a history of our community. It's not about protecting our image, right? Sometimes we might do things a little bit wrong. And I think there's a verse in here that I really want you to understand a little bit more fully than maybe you may have heard it in the past. Some of y'all are young enough, you probably wouldn't have heard some of these talks. I mean, my generation, we heard a verse out of this chapter for many years saying, oh, this verse has been fulfilled. It was fulfilled in 1947, but I think not. All right, Isaiah 66, verse 5. Hear the word of Yahweh, ye that tremble at His word. Your brethren that hated you, that cast you out for my name's sake, said, let Yahweh be glorified. But He shall appear to your joy, and they shall be ashamed. A voice of noise from the city, a voice from the temple, a voice of Yahweh that rendereth recompense to His enemies. Now pay attention. Before she travailed, she brought forth. Before her pain came, she was delivered of a man-child. Who hath heard such a thing? Who hath seen such things? Shall the earth be made to bring forth in one day? Or shall a nation be born at once? As soon as Zion travailed, she brought forth her children. Now, verse 8 has often been used to say, well, this was fulfilled in 1947. But you've got to keep reading. The context doesn't bear that out. And you'll see when we keep reading that this verse fits very well with what the Lord's trying to portray in Matthew 24. Shall I bring to the birth and not cause to bring forth, saith Yahweh? Shall I cause to bring forth and shut the womb, saith thy God? Rejoice ye with Jerusalem, and be glad with her, all ye that love her. Rejoice for joy with her, all ye that mourn for her, that ye may suck and be satisfied with the breast of her consolations, that ye may milk out and be delighted with the abundance of her glory. For thus saith Yahweh, behold, I will extend peace to her like a river, and the glory of the Gentiles like a flowing stream. Doesn't that tell you that this whole prophecy is not fulfilled yet? Does Israel have the glory of the Gentiles in her possession? Not at all. All right? Then shall ye suck, ye shall be borne upon her sides and dandled upon her knees. As one whom his mother comforteth, so will I comfort you, and ye shall be comforted in Jerusalem. And when you see this, your heart shall rejoice, and your bones shall flourish like an herb. And the hand of Yahweh shall be known toward his servants, and his indignation toward his enemies. So, when we go back to Matthew 24 now, and we think about this eighth verse, I think that we see that though the Lord was answering this question to the four disciples, all right, Peter and his brother Andrew, James and his brother John, all right, when he's answering these questions to them, he's going to answer the questions and tell them when the destruction of the Mosaic economy is coming. But there's always this hint of let not your heart be troubled. Though all of this evil is going to come, there's a better day down the road. All right. After this, the Lord will get back on to these signs that lead to the coming destruction of AD 70. Now, I'm going to try to move a little bit quickly. There's some portions of this prophecy I kind of want to try to get through to hit some of the real big highlights, and there will be points where I really slow down. This one I want to try to go through a little bit quicker. Verse 9, Matthew 24. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. You know, I remember when I was a young brother, and I didn't really consider that the Olivet Prophecy was something that primarily referred to AD 70. And I'd read these verses and I'd say, wow, we got a lot coming upon us, don't we? We're going to be thrown into courts. We're going to be killed. We're going to be, you know, put in jail. We're going to suffer all this calamity. This stuff was primarily to them of AD 70. I think the trials that we're going through, and y'all aren't too old not to see it, the trials that we're going through are much more difficult because they're mental struggles and maintaining and preserving the truth. And sometimes that's a whole lot harder. If we were all being persecuted by the world like they were in the first century, we'd probably stand together a little bit firmer and hold on to things a little bit better. Acts chapter 12 shows us that this was indeed fulfilled in the first century. Now, about that time, Herod the king stretched forth his hands to vex certain of the ecclesia, and he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. And because he saw it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to take Peter also. Now, think about this. Of these four men that came to the Lord privately and said, you know, tell us when shall these things be, the Lord is looking right at them and saying, you will be delivered up and be put to death. And we see that one of the four that were standing there in front of them listening to these words, the account in Acts says that he was taken by Herod and he was killed. It did come to pass what the Lord said. 1 Corinthians 4, chapter 9. For I think that God has set forth us, the apostles, last, as it were appointed to death. For we are made a spectacle unto the world, and to angels, and to men. Now, when Paul writes this to the Corinthians, he's not talking about just the fact that all men are going to die. I mean, they were living as men who were appointed unto death. And we know that the traditions of history, which sometimes we don't know how much we can trust the ecclesiastical historians, certainly show forth that all these men were eventually taken and killed. You know, of the apostles, I don't know if ecclesiastical history tells us that any one of them died a death of natural causes. You know, what the Lord said certainly came to pass upon them. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, 8 through 11. We are troubled on every side, yet not distressed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Cast down, but not destroyed. Always bearing about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life also of Jesus might be made manifest in our body. For we which live are always delivered unto death for Jesus' sake, that the life also of Jesus might be made manifest in our mortal flesh. Alright, the next verse, verse 10. The Lord speaks to them and said, there's going to be great offenses and betrayal. Then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. You know, like I said to you when we started on Monday, there's a lot of these things that we look at that we might see echoes in our days, but I really would not provide a double application to them. But we can't help but read through all of the epistles of Paul, particularly, and see that this did happen. You know, the epistles of John. The three that he wrote on the test of true love. I mean, these things were coming to pass. 1 Corinthians 3:3, ye are yet carnal, for whereas there is among you envying and strife and divisions, are you not carnal and walk as men? Was there offense and betrayal? We see it already in the Corinthian ecclesia. 1 Corinthians 6:6, but brother goeth to law with brother, and that before unbelievers. Was there offense and betrayal? There certainly was. 2 Corinthians 11:26, Paul writing of what he went through. Y'all are familiar with this verse. In journeyings often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils by my own countrymen, in perils by the heathen, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren. The offenses and the betrayal that the Lord spoke of were certainly endured in the first century ecclesia. Philippians 1:15, some indeed preach Christ even of envy and strife, and some also of goodwill. Philippians 2:21, for all seek their own, not the things which are Jesus Christ. And then Philippians 3:17 through 19, we have the same type of emphasis that is put forth. What the Lord spoke of afflicted the first century ecclesia without question. They suffered through offense and betrayal. 2 Timothy 3:12 through 14, we've got another good verse that speaks of these things there. 1 John 2:19. Once again, we see that these offenses, these betrayals, they existed in the first century ecclesia. Alright, verse 11 then. The Lord had already warned that before His return there would be false messiahs, but now He's going to say that in verse 11 that there are going to be false prophets that shall arise and shall deceive many. And remember, I told you the story that there was one in particular. As the Roman armies were starting to encircle Jerusalem, there was one guy that stood up and said, "Hey, I'm the Messiah," Josephus records, "follow me." And about 3,000 of them followed him out into the wilderness, into the desert beyond the Dead Sea, and they all died of starvation and exposure there. You know, certainly this was something that the Lord knew would be a danger, particularly as these last days were coming upon Jerusalem. And I think that's one of the things that I want to impress upon you, the importance of what the Lord says and how Peter repeats it, John repeats it later on. You know, as a believer in the first century, as AD 70 was coming up, you could see the temptation to fall prey to these false prophets if you weren't sound in the truth and realized that the Mosaic economy had to go away. And many brethren, I think, were lost to this. Their faith wasn't strong enough because they were too tied into the nationalistic pride that they had as well. They had to grasp hold of the fact that the natural Israelitish community had to pass away so they could be replaced with something better. All right, 1 John does a great job on this subject, doesn't he? And show that there were false prophets without question that had risen in the first century. Beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. Hereby ye know ye the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesseth that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is of God, and every spirit that confesseth not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God. And this is that spirit of Antichrist whereof ye have heard that it should come. Even now already is in the world. Where did they hear about it? The Lord told them about it. The disciples had been repeating it. You heard that it was going to happen. Even now it has come into the world. Alright? They knew that this was happening, just as the Lord said. 1 John 2:18, little children, it is the last time. It's the last hour. It was the last days of the Mosaic economy. And as you have heard that Antichrist shall come, even now are there many Antichrists, whereby we know it is the last time. 1 John 2:26, these things I have written unto you concerning them that seduce you. Jude chapter 4, I guess Lou and I, our class, Brother Lou's in our class is overlapping a little bit here. I'm sure what he's gone over with you on the first three classes fits into this very well, doesn't it? You think about what they were going through. You know, they understood it, even though that I think our time frame goes on a little bit more from there. But Jude says, there are certain men crept in unawares who were before of old ordained to this condemnation, ungodly men turning the grace of God into lasciviousness and denying our the only Lord God and our Lord Jesus Christ. And in 2 Peter 2:1, there were false prophets among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you, who shall privily bring in damnable heresies, even denying the Lord that bought them, and bring upon themselves swift destruction. So the false prophets were prophesied of. They appeared right in that first century. Very easy to trace from the scriptures of what the Lord said would happen did indeed come to pass. Verse 12, Because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold, but he that shall endure unto the end shall be saved. We find an abundance of testimony in the first century ecclesia that this existed as well. Now, certainly this is an echo, I think, to our day. And just because it's an echo that these things exist in our day doesn't mean the Olivet Prophecy was written. These verses were written to point to our day. And I hope particularly as we get a few verses in, you'll see the clear progression of events that the Lord has here if you haven't seen it already. Deuteronomy prophesied of this very event. And I know that this is a busy week. A lot of classes, a lot of talks, a lot to do. It's important for y'all to spend time together while you're here. I'm not trying to encourage y'all, hey, when classes are done, everybody will lock themselves away in your room and not spend time together because y'all really need this time to bond too. But sometime, at least when you get home, if you don't find it this week, I really want you to read through the entirety of Deuteronomy 28. A highly important chapter, very significant as regards to the Olivet Prophecy. And what Jesus is saying here, Moses had already prophesied would happen. And you really need to read through all of those verses in Deuteronomy 28 and see how it even leads up to AD 70. And you'll see it soon. Moses said in verse 54 there, so that the man that is tender among you and very delicate, his eye shall be evil towards his brother, and toward the wife of his bosom, and toward the remnant of his children, which he shall leave. Moses even said the same thing, that before the destruction of the commonwealth, love was going to wax cold. James 4, 1 through 4, from whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence even of your lust that warn your members? Ye lust and have not. Ye kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. Ye fight and war, yet ye have not, because ye ask not. Ye ask and receive not, because ye ask amiss, that ye may consume it upon your lust. Ye adulterers and adulterers, know ye not that friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enmity of God. We can see that they were already developing problems. They were loving the world more than the love of God. And that was the love that started to wax cold. The love of the truth. The love of Yahweh. Alright, verse 14. This is one of those verses that my generation heard an awful lot of when I was first learning the truth, and we were being told that hey, you young people, y'all need to all get up and go out and preach the gospel because Christ can't even return until it goes to everybody. We got to tell everybody about the gospel or else he can't return. I'm disappointed that as a young man I was taught that that's what this verse meant. It's not that we shouldn't teach people the truth. We should. Should we be willing to talk to anybody? Absolutely. But I don't want anybody to ever have the opinion that verse 14 is written in such a way that Christ says of our generation that he can't return until every single person hears the truth. And that was how it was portrayed to me as a young man. Verse 14, and this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. I don't know if I've put it on the slide. I haven't. I'm not going to go back. You can look.
you stand right here. You know how you put something up, you don't want to lose anybody's attention. The word for world in the Greek text here in Matthew is an important one. All right, how many Greek words are you familiar with for world? We've already talked about one, aeon, right? Anybody know another Greek word for world in the scriptures? Hannah? Cosmos? All right. Is that the one you were going to say, Colton? There's one more that you may not know about. Does anybody know the other one? There's another word, and it's here. It's the Greek word oikoumene. All right, I'm sure I didn't pronounce that right. Oikoumene. And it is a Greek word that was used in the vernacular of the day to describe the then habitable world, as opposed to where all the barbarians live. All right? So what was chosen by the Spirit, because we, you know, contrary to what some people say, you know, I don't think the Lord was speaking Greek at this point in time. There's a reason why they, you know, spoke in the Hebrew tongue on the day of Pentecost. But there's a reason why this Greek term is used by Matthew to record it. Because the sign was then that the gospel was going to be preached to the then known habitable world, the Roman dominion. Every creature was going to hear it. And that was going to be a sign to all the disciples and the believers that when you had finally reached that point, that y'all had been able to go over all the nations in the city of the then habitable world, that your mission was coming to a close and the end of the Mosaic economy was then going to come to a close. You know, sometimes I think as young people we wonder, you know, why is it that at the crucifixion of the Lord, the Mosaic economy just wasn't immediately just wiped out? Why didn't it just go away right then? Was there any efficacy to the Mosaic ordinance after that? There wasn't. Not one bit. So the question might be, why? I think the very important reason why is found in that. Where did most believers come from that the disciples went to? We're not saying that there weren't a lot of Gentiles that heard the truth. There were. But primarily it was Paul going into these synagogues in Corinth and Galatia and Ephesus, going to his Jewish brethren and speaking to them. This transition period that existed from AD 30 to 70 really gave them an audience to speak about the gospel. And so he says to them, you will be able to go to the then known habitable. Remember we read a verse earlier from Matthew chapter 10 verse 23. You will not have gone over all the cities of Israel until I have come, till my parousia. Same kind of idea. Colossians 1, 5 through 6 gives us a clear answer to this command, doesn't it? For the hope which is laid up for you in heaven, whereof ye heard before in the word of truth of the gospel, which is come unto you, as it is in all the world, and bringeth forth fruit, as it doth also in you, since the day ye heard of it, and knew the grace of God in truth. Paul tells the Colossians right here, the gospel had been preached to all the world. Verse 23 of the same chapter. If you continue in faith, grounded and settled, and be not moved away from the hope of the gospel, which ye have heard, and which was preached to every creature which is under heaven, whereof I, Paul, am made a minister. Now, we do know there's a fact that there were people that were living in the barbarian lands that at this point in time had not heard the gospel. But Paul says here that the gospel had been preached to every creature which is under heaven. You know, he was speaking of the heaven of the then known habitable world. So we have testimony that this 14th verse of Matthew 24 was indeed fulfilled before the end came. Alright, abomination of desolations. Let's focus a little bit more intently on what takes place now in Matthew. And we're going to probably have a little bit of opportunity to go into Luke as well. And I can't believe it's already 10:43. Didn't I just start? Okay, where does the phrase abomination of desolation come from other than Matthew 24:15? What book? Daniel. It's mentioned three times in Daniel. And
This is not a class about the abomination of desolations. But it's very important for me to tell you that there are three different times the abomination of desolation is mentioned in Daniel, and none of the three refer to the same time period. Okay? None of the three refer to the same time period. That's pretty important for you to know. Daniel's abominations that he spoke of that are referring to this time period, certainly at Daniel chapter 8, chapter 9 is referring to here. Obviously, there's one of them that relates to AD 70 because the Lord says it right here in verse 15. Okay? We have another abomination of desolation mentioned in Daniel in chapter 11, which refers to Antiochus Epiphanes. Isn't that like every Wednesday of every year we get a flyover from the National Guard? And then we have an abomination of desolation mentioned in Daniel 12, which is clearly a future event that has not yet come to pass. But Jesus says here that, in verse 15, when ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Well, there's a pretty clear reference there that this was written to the first century believer, right? If this was a prophecy that referred to the latter days, we would have to just say, okay, only brethren in Judea flee into the mountains. Everybody else, fine, stay right where you are. Everything's good, right? But the context bears out who he's speaking to and what the discussion is going by. Let him which is in Judea flee into mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. But pray that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. Are we living under the Sabbath day law now? I mean, well, in a spiritual sense, somebody could have nodded their head yes, and I would have accepted that. But, you know, and we'll talk about this in a minute. Now I'm really getting ahead of my notes. It was really important for the Jews to pray that their flight wouldn't be on the Sabbath day, because then not only were they going to have to worry about the Roman armies, but what was going to happen to them if they were trying to flee on the Sabbath day? The Pharisees would be trying to stone them. You're going more on a Sabbath day journey. Can't do that. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world, the Mosaic world, to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. All right, I want to start with one comment here that I think is very, very important. And I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand ahead of this. I thought I might do that. One of the things that we sometimes discuss politely amongst brethren is the importance of prophecy. Is prophecy so important that it's doctrine? Is it something that we should consider first principle? Should we get so bent out of shape that we understand it right? You know, what's the big deal if we all understand prophecy a little bit differently? It's no big deal. Well, I think this verse we're looking at right now shows us how big of a deal it is. The first century believers' very lives depended upon a correct understanding of Daniel. Was Jesus Christ unfair when he gave these first century believers a sign that said, here's one of the things you're going to know when you need to flee into the mountains. When you see the abomination of desolation stand in the holy place, you know that it's time for you to get out. Think anybody stuck up their hand and said, whoa, wait a second, Lord, prophecy is not a first principle. It was a matter of life and death. So what I would encourage you is while we know that the prophetic word can sometimes be difficult for us to come to a correct understanding, that's what we have to strive towards. These brethren's very lives depended upon a correct understanding of the abomination of desolation. That was their sign. Let's look at Daniel 8. while I'm turning over to Daniel 8, I'll just tell you this. The book of Daniel also closes with a very important statement. It says, the wise are going to understand. That should be kind of scary to all of us. All this prophetic word's given to us, and the wise are going to understand it. If we can't understand it, it tells us something. We're not wise, right? In the beginning of that 12th chapter tells us something else. Who is it that's going to shine as the brightness in the firmament? The resurrected body. It's the wise. So there's a task ahead of each and every one of us to seek to be wise even in these matters. All right, Daniel 8, verses 10 through 12. Speaking of the little horn here that comes forth out of the ram. All right, we've got the story here of the ram and the he-goat. So the little horn that comes forth out of the goat. We don't have a lot of time to go through Daniel 8, but we know that when we talk about the ram, it represented what power? Somebody shout it out that knows the answer real fast. Ram is... I'm disappointed. Medo-Persia, right? Somebody read verse 20. It's right there for you, isn't it? Chad, you got a big booming voice. Read verse 20 there.
The ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia.
All right, verse 21. I should have just told you to do both of them.
All right. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king.
All right. And then when you get to verse 20, we see that the Grecian horn is broken up. It's divided into four parts, and we've got a new power that rises up. Who came after Greece? Rome, right? So then when we get to verse 10, because this 20th and 21st, 22nd verse is describing what Daniel had already seen. Verse 10, then speaking of the Roman power, it says, and it waxed great, even to the host of heaven. And it cast down some of the host of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. That's going to be an echo to Matthew 24, 29. Think about that, okay? It cast some of the stars down to the ground. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression. And it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. It's a brief description of the overthrow of the city of Jerusalem in AD 70 here. Daniel chapter 9 describes it this way in verses 26 and 27. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. So we're talking about the destruction of AD 70 by the Romans. Pay attention how this destruction is described here. In the end shall be with a flood. It's kind of an echo to Matthew 24 again, the days of Noah. I want you to think about that. File that away for when we get there Thursday or Friday. Probably Friday. Especially the way I'm interrupting my notes. And unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. And in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. You know from previous classes that's a reference to Christ's sacrifice, right? The 70 weeks prophecy is taking us to the death of Christ, to his sacrifice. And for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate. So there's the abomination of desolation that Jesus refers to. It's Matthew chapter 9. He expected his followers to understand what was being spoken of there. He tells them, when you see the abomination of desolation stand, flee into the mountain. Now Luke's account gives us a big help here. Particularly, who did Luke write to primarily? His audience was made up of what class of people? Say it louder, Robin.
Gentiles.
Right. So Luke's not going to use the phrase abomination of desolation because he knows the reader isn't as familiar with it. So when you look at Luke 21 and verse 20, I want you to notice how Luke phrases it because this is very quick and easy to understand. Luke 21, 20. And when ye see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Alright, he makes reference to the abomination of desolation there. Know that the desolation thereof nigh, but he gives us just a very clear sentence. When you see Jerusalem compassed with armies, know that the desolation thereof is nigh. So that was the sign that they needed to look forward to. A couple years ago, I gave this class, and there was an older brother came up to me after. He goes, "Mac, I just don't agree with you. I think all of this applies to the latter days." And I looked at the brother and said, "Well, I'm glad, because for years I've been hearing you say the goat's never going to invade the land of Israel." And he looked at me astonished. He goes, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, because Luke says Jerusalem's going to be compassed about with armies and the desolations thereof nigh. You can't have it both ways." So, you know, we see this being spoken of here, and it happened in this first century. The city was compassed about with armies. Verse 16. I got about 6 minutes, and I might try to move somewhat quickly through some of this stuff. Verse 16 then says, "Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountain." It's because that's who it directly applied to. If this was a message intended for each and every one of us living in the last days, don't you think it'd be a little bit less pointed? Why only talk to those that are living in Judea? Right? Verse 17. "Then let them which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house." You know, don't come down out of the housetop. You know, there's a couple things that I think is interesting here. The reference in Deuteronomy 28, and I'm trying to talk too fast. I'm going to have to force myself to slow down and not hurry, is really interesting. And this is why I want you to read the whole chapter. Deuteronomy 28 and verse 30 says this: "Israel, if you don't obey the word of God, here's what's going to happen to you. Then shall you betray the wife, and another man shall lie with her. Thou shalt build an house, and thou shalt not dwell therein. You'll plant vineyards, and you'll not gather the grapes thereof." Moses had already told them their possessions were going to be of no value to them if they were disobedient. The Lord's saying the same thing here. Don't think about your house. Don't think about what you can gather as far as clothes. Don't think about anything. It won't matter. You need to go. Don't come down from the housetop. And I think it's also an interesting thing. Let him which is on the housetop not come down. I think there's also a little bit of a warning there. For those Israelites that had a problem with idolatry, where was the place that they were likely to keep their idols? On the roof. On the housetop. You know, Moses and Jesus are kind of agreeing here. It's going to be because of the false worship and the false belief that caused the nation to be destroyed. But it was destined to take place. Verse 18, and I shouldn't turn out of Deuteronomy 28. In fact, I should have told you that until the bell rings, keep your fingers in Matthew and in Deuteronomy 28. The Lord says, don't bother to come down to get any of your clothes. Don't take time for it. Deuteronomy 28, verse 33. "The fruit of thy land and thy labor shall a nation which thou knowest not eat up, and thou shalt be only oppressed and crushed." Verse 48, "Therefore shalt thou serve thine enemies, which Yahweh shall send against thee, in hunger, and in thirst, and in nakedness." Right? Moses and Jesus agree then, don't they? You're not going to have time to come get your clothes. You're going to serve in nakedness. Verse 51 of the chapter, "And he shall eat of the fruit of thy cattle, and of the fruit of thy land, until thou be destroyed, which also shall not leave thee either corn, wine, or oil, or increase of thy vine, or flocks or sheep, until he have destroyed thee." We go on. Verse 19 says, "And woe unto them that are with child in those days that give them suck." Look at what verse 28 says about these last days and what would happen to their children. Verse 41, "Thou shalt beget sons and daughters, but thou shalt not enjoy them, for they shall go into captivity." And then this is particularly disturbing to read what Moses says in many ways, but it came to pass in AD 70. For those of you that know your history, particularly of what happened on Masada, what I'm about ready to read rings very true, and it makes you understand why the Lord said in the days before AD 70, "Woe to them that give suck." to those that wouldn't flee. If you didn't understand the prophecy and you stayed in Jerusalem, if you thought that you were going to be delivered and everything was going to be okay, here's what Moses says. Verse 53, "Thou shalt eat the fruit of thine own body, the flesh of thy sons, and of thy daughters, which Yahweh thy God hath given thee, in the siege and in the straitness wherewith thine enemy shall distress thee, so that the man that is tender among you and very delicate, his eye shall be evil towards his brother, and toward the wife of his bosom, and toward the remnant of his children, which he shall leave, so that he will not give to any of them of his flesh of his children whom he shall eat, because he hath nothing left him in the siege and in the straitness wherewith thine enemy shall distress thee in all thy gates. The tender and delicate woman among you, which would not adventure to set the sole of her foot upon the ground for delicateness and tenderness, her eye shall be evil towards the husband of her bosom, and toward her son, and toward her daughter." On Masada, what were they doing because of the starvation before the Romans destroyed him? They were eating their children. The Lord's words were very true. "Woe unto you that give suck in those days." The horrendous things that happened in those last days in Jerusalem when the starvation really set in are difficult to even speak about. But Moses makes an allusion to it here. He tells them exactly what was going to happen in the days when, verse 48, the yoke of iron would be put upon their neck. In verse 49, the nation like unto the eagle would come upon them. Now remember that verse. We're about ready to come to it in Matthew, aren't we? "For wherever the carcass is, there shall the eagles be gathered together." What Moses said would have been a great grief of mind, I think. And that's why it was important for them to understand the book of Daniel. The believer needed to know when to leave. And we've got a hymn that you sing about all the time that makes reference to this time period. Where does that hymn tell us, and we know this historically to be true, that the believers went? What'd you say, Robin? Tapella. "They which Tapella fled." You know, there were believers, they understood what the Lord said here. They were wise enough to see that the abomination of desolation had come, and they fled. All right, verse 20 has a note here. "Pray that your flight be not in the winter, nor on the Sabbath day." And the reference here in Nehemiah 13:19 I've got because, you know, we see in even Nehemiah's day that Nehemiah, he set that Sabbath law firmly in place again in his days because people were ignoring it. If you took more than a Sabbath day journey, you were liable to be stoned. Were people still stoning in the time of the first century ecclesia? Certainly so. What happened to Stephen, right? This was a real danger for the believer. The believer needed to hope that they weren't going to have to flee on a Sabbath day. I mean, they understood that at this point in time that the Sabbath day was something that the Jew wasn't understanding. But that was a risk to them. If they were going to have to flee on a Sabbath day, not only were they going to have to worry about the Romans, they were going to have to worry about stones being thrown at them by their own brethren. Verse 21, and I've been waiting for the bell to ring, and I'm sure glad Sid's going a little bit long, but I also want to take more time on this than I'm going to be able to. Verse 21, "For then shall there be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world." All right, once again, we're referring to the beginning of that Mosaic aeon. "To this time, nor ever shall be." I'm also going to tell you, if you're already thinking, Mac, how are you going to explain to me verse 22, which talks about the elect? Isn't the elect a phrase that we use about the saints? I'm going to show you some references in the epistles where the phrase elect is clearly used of Israel. And there's one in particular in the book of Romans that I challenge you young people to find where the phrase elect, a form of the word, is used in relation to natural Israel. It's probably in one of those well-known chapters, so think about it. We're going to come back because I want to talk about Malachi 4 tomorrow, and I want to show you how Malachi 4, which clearly is a prophecy of our day, has an application to AD 70 as well. And we're going to prove that as we go through. All right. Thank you for being patient because I kind of...